All right, 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 8. 2 Timothy 4, 8. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on that day, and not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing. We're going to add to that verse a chapter from the Old Testament in Genesis 12. So come back to Genesis chapter 12, where we will read a chapter in the life of Abraham. Genesis chapter 12. Genesis 12, starting at verse 1. Now the Lord had said to Abram, "Get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Then Abram took Sarah, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had acquired, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran. And they departed to go to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan. Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem, as far as the terebinth tree of Moreh. And the Canaanites were in the land then. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your descendants I will give this land." And there he built an altar to the Lord, who had appeared to him. And he moved from there to the mountain east of Bethel, and he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west of Ai, on the east. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. So Abram journeyed, going on still toward the south. Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to dwell there, for the famine was severe in the land. And it came to pass, when he was close to entering Egypt, that he said to Sarah his wife, "Indeed, I know that you are a woman of beautiful countenance. Therefore it will happen, when the Egyptians see you, that they will say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me, but they will let you live. Please say you are my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I will live because of you." So it was, when Abram came into Egypt, that the Egyptians saw the woman, that she was very beautiful. The princes of Pharaoh also saw her, and commended her to Pharaoh. And the woman was taken to Pharaoh's house, and he treated Abram well for her sake. He had sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male and female servants, female donkeys, and camels. But the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarah, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister? I might have taken her as my wife. Now, therefore, here is your wife. Take her, go, and go your way." So Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and with all that he had. Now we're going to stop our reading there. The title of today's message is "The Long-Term Propagating Effects of Our Lives and Decisions." The long-term propagating effects of our lives and decisions. And we're going to look at it both in bad and good things. Hopefully we won't spend as much time on the bad direction, because I want it to be an encouraging message, but it is possible to look at it in both bad and good ways. And if you think about who I might turn to in the Bible to talk about somebody and the long-term propagating effects of their life and decisions, the top candidates would be, well, the Lord himself, our supreme example. Adam would be a good choice in terms of Adam and Eve's, the long-term propagating effects of their lives. But after those cases, Abraham would probably be way up at the top of the remainder of the list in terms of the effect that his life had on the world and on eternity for the long term. And we're going to see it germinating here in Genesis 12 and what happens to follow. So that's what we're going to look at, the long-term propagating effects of our lives and decisions, both bad and good. Now, before we get into that, I have a little puzzle for you, and that is this question. When is the judgment seat of Christ? When does it take place? I imagine everybody here knows this well, but when I was at Aletheia Springs some years ago, we talked about some end-time things. So I gave them, I divided them into groups, and I gave them little index cards with different future things happening on them. So there was the eternal state was on there, the rapture was on there, the tribulation was on there, the covenant that the Antichrist would make was on there, the judgment seat of Christ, the rapture, I think I've said those, and anyway, various future things, the millennium was on there and so on, coming to earth of the Lord was on there. And so what I had them do was that each group had to organize these cards in order of chronological order. So you'd be surprised what would happen, right? I mean, the eternal state you would think you'd put right at the end automatically, just straight out. Didn't always appear at the end. And one group had the judgment seat of Christ coming before the rapture. Now, I said, now this one I couldn't let go. I was just like, how do you have the judgment seat of Christ before the rapture? And believe it or not, the answer was not as crazy as it sounds, because the person who was responsible for saying that that's where it belonged spoke up and said, well, it's true that those that are raptured, the judgment seat of Christ will be after the rapture, but whenever you die and you go to heaven, your life is evaluated. This is what he said, not saying that's the truth. I said, so you're saying that everybody has their own judgment seat of Christ, which is an evaluation of their life? He says, yes. And that happens whenever they die. Whenever a person dies, they have their own judgment seat of Christ. In other words, their life is evaluated. He said, yeah, yes, that's right. Well, I had not thought of it that way. Now, I knew he was wrong, but I didn't know why he was wrong, because I had not even considered it. So at least he had a plausible reason for putting the judgment seat of Christ where he did. So this brings up the question, is it right that we have our individual judgment seat of Christ right after we die? Or do we just kind of go to heaven and wait for everybody to catch up, and then there's one big judgment seat of Christ for everybody? Well, or is it that those who die wait until the rapture and wait until all that it applies to would be gathered together? And the answer comes in the first verse we read, 2 Timothy 4:8. And now, see, I didn't have a good answer for that kid right then, other than to say, well, I know you're wrong, but just we don't have time to go into that right now. But later I realized this is the verse. Now look at what Paul says very carefully. Henceforth there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give me at when? That day. And what else will happen at that day? And not to me only, but also all them that love his appearing. Meaning that, which of the two is it? We all have our individual judgment seat of Christ the moment we die, or that it will be all together? The answer is it will be all together. And we know that from 2 Timothy 4:8. So the little fellow there, even though he had thought it through nicely, he was wrong. And we know from Scripture that he was wrong. Fine. Now, Here's maybe a different question, not when is the judgment seat of Christ, but why is the judgment seat of Christ at the time it is? In other words, why doesn't it happen the way he said? That's just the way it is in the Bible, and we just trust the Lord. Well, yeah, of course. Of course. But is there any reason why it's held until we all get there? The answer, I believe, is this. Because it is only at the end when the propagating effects of our lives are known. You see, the effect of a person's life goes on beyond their death. We're going to look at Abraham. Now, I'm going to call him Abraham throughout this message, even though at this time in his life he's called Abram. We're going to find out that a lot of the effects of Abraham's life occur after he died. And concerning the judgment seat of Christ, it says, no other foundation can any man lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. But then the scripture goes on to say, take heed how everyone builds on that foundation. Now, when will that foundation, what is being built on that foundation, be completed? Be completed at the completion of the church at the rapture. And it's only after that that all of these propagating effects of our lives will be known for what they are. So the judgment seat of Christ happens at the end, and there's a reason why it happens at the end, because it's only then that the propagating of effects of our lives are known. So let me just give you an example. Long ago, there was a missionary in Syria. Long ago, meaning far before I was even born. This missionary in Syria did labors in Syria and preached the gospel and did evangelistic efforts there. These evangelistic efforts led to evangelistic influence in my grandparents' household. And that's, of course, the household in which my father grew up. That affected his life, and that evangelistic influence he brought with him here to the United States in 1954, and that evangelistic influence has affected my life and the rest of his children's lives and their children's lives. Now, if you had asked the missionary in Syria, are your labors affecting what goes on in the United States in the year 2015 at Rockville Bible Fellowship? What? But it's only when all is known at the end that a person's life is reviewed and all of the long-term propagating effects of their life comes in view. So there's an example for us to keep in mind. So the purpose of today's message is to encourage our hearts in understanding that we should judge nothing before the time, that God can use our efforts at times might seem of little fruit to his glory even in generations to come. And Abraham's going to be our example. He saw little fruit immediately, but God used him, of course, in tremendous ways throughout generations. So let's look now at this, what we've read in Genesis chapter 12. And I'd like to begin with the second half of the chapter, and that is the part of the chapter that deals with his going down to Egypt. Now, if you remember, as we get up to that, the Lord had appeared to him several times. He'd appeared to him and spoke to him back in Ur of the Chaldees, and we read about that at his stop in Haran, and then he comes to Canaan. So he gets to Canaan, and the Lord appears to him again, and the Lord continues to talk to him and says, you're going to have descendants. Now, there is this famine in the land, and we do not read of the Lord appearing to Abraham, telling him to go down to Egypt. The last of the Lord's commands was to go into the land. No command to go into Egypt. Why go into Egypt? There's a famine in the land, I'm going to die. Was Abraham going to die? No. How do you know Abraham was not going to die? How could Abraham have known he was not going to die? God gave him what? Promises of descendants. So when Abraham leaves the land, he may think he was going to die. When he gets to the edge of Egypt, he says he thinks he's going to die. He says, well, Sarah, now, I know you're well into your 60s, but you're still a looker, and we, you know, they're going to see you, they're going to kill me because they think I'm married to you, they'll kill me to get to you. I'm afraid for my life. Would they have killed him? Now, it's easier for us in the safety of our chairs where we are looking back, but okay, well, let's take it from our safe point of view. Would they have killed him? The answer is no. God promised him he was going to have descendants. But he tells this lie, even though Sarah's his half-sister, he says it in a way which implies she is not my wife, which is a lie. And he goes and says this, and we know what happens. Now, in the end, the Lord protects Abraham. So is this true? All's well that ends well. Because look, at the end of the chapter, Abraham leaves unscathed. He leaves with lots of gifts given to him by Pharaoh. We read about those, all the donkeys and the sheep and goats and camels and whatever else is written there, men servants, maid servants. So he leaves unscathed with gifts and with his wife protected and with himself protected. And they go back. So is it true, all's well that ends well? We're going to see, no, his decisions now in a negative way have serious consequences. Let's look at them in detail. First of all, let's read the first verse of Genesis 13. Then Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him. Meaning that even though we didn't read it in Genesis 12, Genesis 13 now tells us that Lot was with him during this trip. Interesting. Well, what happens with regard to that? It turns out that both of them were increased with goods. We can read about that in the verses mentioned. 13:5 would say this, Lot also, who went with Abraham, had flocks and herds and tents. And it turns out that the goods divided them. Genesis 13:6-9 is the, you know it well, Abraham has to tell Lot, look, there's all this strife between us. Where'd the strife come from? We have too much stuff, too many cattle. So we're going to have to separate. That's the best solution that we have. How is it that they came about to have too much stuff? Abraham's decision going down to Egypt. Now, Abraham had a lot before going down, but he increased because of what Pharaoh gave him. So if Abraham was going to have some good influence on Lot, that was going to disappear because they're going to be divided. Furthermore, look at what Lot does when he gets his choice of where to go. 13:10. Lot lifted his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. This is before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Like the garden of the Lord. Now look at what the next phrase says. Like the land of Egypt. In other words, how did Lot know it was like the land of Egypt? Abraham took him there. The consequences, the propagation of bad decisions is now finding its way into Lot's life. And even though Abraham was able to go to Egypt and come back without that taste for Egypt and that craving for Egypt, that wasn't so with Lot. Because Lot, when he's given a choice now of where to go, he says, oh yeah, that looks like Egypt. I got a taste for that, and I like it. And now he's going to go to Sodom. And soon Lot is not just near Sodom, he's in Sodom. He's in the gate, his own relatives destroyed as Sodom gets destroyed. And note that any good in Sodom that Lot ever was able to do, if he was able to do any good, was destroyed. I mean, if you met Lot partway in his career in Sodom, and he's like, look, I know it's a bad place, okay? We all know it's a bad place. But we're getting some things done. I mean, I've I'm starting to get into government there, and we've got a couple of laws changed that I think are going to turn the tide, and I think things are going to get better. All his efforts, what happened to them? Any good that he might have done was destroyed when Sodom was destroyed. And we want to think about that with regard to our lives here on earth, because if improvements that we make to this world are only improvements in this world, they're going to get destroyed at the end. It is only things that we do that have eternal effect that will last through till eternity. So think about Lot in Sodom, and any good that he might have been able to do there got destroyed along with the city. So Abram's bad decision had a propagating effect on Lot, but it also had a propagating effect on the rest of the world, because if we remember in verse 16 of chapter 12, he received servants while he was there, men servants and maid servants. We don't read about this until chapter 16. Good old Hagar, it says the Egyptian. Where did Hagar come from? Egypt. His servant, his Egyptian servant. I take it she came about as part of the gifts that came in from his bad decision in Genesis 12. From her, Ishmael is born, and he's described not only himself as a wild man, but his descendants after him. And as we well know, that much of the Muslim world today traces to Ishmael. And we can read about the verse that describes in particular him. It says, "He shall be a wild donkey of a man. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren." I don't know to what all generations this verse applies, but it is interesting to see, even today, ISIS and Al-Qaeda and things of that nature and what's happening. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand shall be against him. And it's interesting to see, however you would like to take it and how far you would like to apply it, you have to admit that Abraham's decision of going down to Egypt propagated into a lot of negative effects. All right, so let's go from bad news to good news. There's good news in the propagation of Abraham's effect on the world. Abraham, as we read in the first half of Genesis 12, was to be a father of a line and have descendants after him, a very special line. We know that Christ would come through this line, and his line, his seed of descendants, would be a blessing to the world. So he was given this promise, and let's see how he influenced the world for good now instead of for bad. Well, Abraham had one son of promise. Now, he had other sons, but one son of promise, Isaac. And he had Isaac when he was 100 years old. So he was given this promise at the age 75. So if you asked him 20 years later when he's 95, "Abram, what's God going to do with you in this life? What is your greatest accomplishment?" "Well, according to God's promise, it's going to be that I'm going to be a blessing to the whole world with descendants." "Okay, where are they?" "Well, I don't have anything to show yet." "Abram, you're 95. I believe God, it's going to happen, but nothing yet." "All right." After Abraham is 100, he has Isaac. Now he has Isaac, and Isaac's growing a little bit, and you go talk to Abraham and say, "Abraham, now, what are you going to do for the world?" "Oh, no, great blessing is going to come through me. Let me tell you, God promised it. Great nation, deliverance, blessing to the world. Where is this?" "Well, I have Isaac." "How many descendants do you have?" "According to this promise," that is, that fit the description of this promise, how many descendants do you have now?" "One." "That's all right, give it time. Rome wasn't built in a day." So when Abraham is 160, Isaac gives birth to Jacob. Now, we're not going to look at Esau for the moment because he wasn't part of this promise. So Isaac produces one. Abraham's 165 now, so you go to talk to Abraham. Abraham, now what are you going to do with this life of yours? Oh, God has big plans for my life on this world. I'm going to be a blessing. My descendants are going to be a blessing. A great nation. All the world's going to be blessed through me eventually. What do you have to show? I have one son. Well, okay, what does he have to show? One son. Judge nothing before the time, though. Abraham now dies at 175. There's a 15-year overlap with Jacob. And Hebrews says that the three dwelt together in tents for that 15 years. Even if Abraham lived to be 225 years old, he would have only seen that. But you know the story. Jacob has 12 sons. Now we're getting somewhere. 12 turn into 70. 70 go down to Egypt. They grow within Egypt and become a nation. They're delivered out of Egypt as a nation. And the nation of Israel is born, and the rest is history. Eventually, the Lord would come through that line, the Savior of the world. So let's look at this now. We have not much seen up until Jacob. So within Abraham's life, he saw little fruit in terms of his physical line, but that was not the end. And the encouragement is the same is true concerning spiritual fruit in countless lives through the centuries of the church. There are countless lives that have been laid down for the Lord where if you looked at the fruit of that life, you would say, I'm not sure I see a lot of fruit. But the judgment seat of Christ is not at that person's death. There is long-term propagating effect a lot of times. You look at Jim Elliot. He went down as a missionary, as a young man, had all the potential in the world. And as he starts to make his way with the others, the five that were trying to evangelize the, I think it was the Aka Indian people there down there. You know the story. This is in the 50s when they were killed. They were murdered. Their lives are ended. There was so much potential for fruit. And now we don't see any fruit. And their lives are ended. Good thing the judgment seat of Christ didn't happen at the moment they died, because there are stories of dozens and dozens and dozens of people who, because of that, said, I'm going to go to the mission field. And I know one of them. She's elderly now, and she told me that that is the reason she went to Africa as a missionary, based on what happened to them. Don't judge anything till the end. Some people in their Christian life, they have little fruit that they can see, but don't judge anything before the time. Let's talk about another example, August Frank. Now, by show of hands, who knows about the life of August Frank? Okay. Let's not talk about August Frank. All right. Let's talk about George Mueller. There we go. We know about him. We know about Mueller and his orphanages. He's a man of faith. I just finished reading about his life. All my life, I've just heard the stories about his life. And if you ask me, do you know about George? Oh, yeah, I know about him. I've heard about his stories. Read it. It's wonderful. I've been blessed tremendously. He decided a few things early on when he thought that the Lord was leading him to start an orphanage in Bristol. He decided they're not going to borrow any money. He's never going to make a need known to anybody except to God in prayer. And he was penniless. Let's start an orphanage. How much money do you have? None. Who are you going to get the money from? I'm not telling a soul. I'm just going to pray about it. And started an orphanage. It turned out that his orphanage he started through prayer and not soliciting a soul turned out to grow into five enormous buildings that housed 2,000 orphans at a time. 10,000 orphans were cared for, fed, and clothed throughout his ministry without his ever borrowing a cent or asking anybody for a cent, only taking his request to the Lord. And he kept a meticulous journal because he had three purposes in doing this. The first was to be a testimony for the glory of God that God answers prayer. That was his first and foremost priority. So he intentionally would not tell anybody his needs because he had a specific task and a mission to do this for the glory of God and to show that God answers prayer. His second need was to evangelize the orphans that came through the orphanage, concerned about their spiritual well-being, and the third was to be concerned about their physical well-being. And throughout his ministry, he was oftentimes taken to the brink of pennilessness, sometimes the night before. There's no breakfast for the kids the next morning, and the Lord always came through, and the kids never went without a nourishing meal. All right, so his faith, read the story, it's wonderful. But what's interesting is because of his meticulous notes and journal called his narrative, which he published as time went on, other people would read about these. Other people got the idea to start other orphanages. There was one started in Japan. Others were started in England where he was. It said in England alone, it's estimated that 100,000 orphans were cared for. Even though his was only 10,000, 100,000 because of his pioneer-setting example that others followed. So other orphanages came about. Hudson Taylor, who went to China, was tremendously influenced by Mueller, and as his protege, if you will, went on to China. And so the whole story of his life we'll hear about another time in terms of founding China Inland Mission and so on. The orphans that went through the orphanages, a lot of them were saved and went on for the Lord in various parts of the world to where late in George Mueller's life, he was in San Francisco of all places and is greeted by one of the orphans in his orphanages. And he's ministering in a church in San Francisco and going on well for the Lord, the propagation of this. A fellow in Ireland reads George Mueller's narrative, says, well, wait a minute. If God answers prayer like that for George Mueller, he can answer it for me too. So he starts praying that the Lord would give him another like-minded believer that shares his heart for the gospel. So one became two. The Lord answered that prayer. So these two start praying together. Two became four. And these four like-minded people started praying together. And there was a, starting small but getting bigger, a revival in Ireland that was sparked because of reading what George Mueller did with his orphanages. And it's affected another person in a good way, that's me. So count me in the list of the propagating influence of his life. Now, these others have gone on to do things, as you can see, right? Been a long-lasting effect of him. So Mueller's building on the foundation of the church cannot be evaluated until the end of the church, can it? Why does the judgment seat of Christ come at the end? That's the sensible place for it. That's when man's works and woman's works will be made known for what they are. Now, what I'd like to do, which is really interesting, is go back to talk about this guy named Herman Frank. Because it turns out, over 100 years before Mueller came on the scene, there was a man named August Frank who started, of all things, an orphanage. And this is in the later 1600s when he started his orphanage. And he was a believer, and he relied on the Lord, and he said, I'm going to rely on the Lord for this orphanage. And he did. It was pretty big, but it was not the scale of Mueller, what God did through Mueller. But that was well over 100 years before. And when Mueller was a young man, about 25, he had been a believer for about 5 years now. Because of his Mueller, by the way, he was a scoundrel in his unsaved days. He even was in prison, a debtor's prison, for just taking money and not paying it back and just stealing anything he could anywhere. What a change. Anyway, Mueller ends up spending 2 months of his life in this building that houses people, and he's like, what is this building? It turns out he learns that the building was at one time the orphanage started by August Frank. Huh. Well, let me look into what does this guy Frank do? He started this building that I've been in for 2 months. He was an orphanage, and he relies on the Lord. He relies on the Lord, and he started this orphanage to care for the needy and to preach the gospel to them. Huh. Life goes on for George Mueller. A little bit later, the Lord starts pressing on his life. He needs to be used. And he says, you know, August Frank, he built that orphanage, and he relied only on the Lord to do it. I think the Lord is having me to do that. Now, how are you going to evaluate August Frank's life? Do you understand how impossible it would be if you lived in the 1600s to look at his life and say, I know how his life is going to be evaluated at the end. I know how he built on that foundation. What the Lord did with it, we don't know, because the story's still going on, isn't it? Fascinating to think about. Turns out he did a lot. One of his students was Zinzendorf, who has his own story, and there were a bunch of others as well. So it's just fascinating to think about this. Doesn't this give the advantage to the older you are, the more advantage you have, because there's more time to propagate things? It may be so, but don't worry. The Lord deals fairly with people, and those that were hired at the 11th hour, he knows they were hired at the 11th hour, and he treats them rightly. So judge nothing before the time. We'll end with two verses that sum up what we're saying. 1 Corinthians 4:5, therefore judge nothing before the time until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the hidden things of darkness and reveal the counsels of hearts. Then each one's praise will come from God. And to encourage us to be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. And if you see yourself like Abraham and you've lived a life and you say, you know, I can point to an Isaac that I've affected and I can point to a Jacob, but I can't point to anybody else, take heart. Don't judge things before the time. You don't know what things are going to be like thereafter. And God used Abraham in the way he did, even though Abraham saw little fruit, and he does the same with his saints today. Father, thank you that you take us unworthy, unworthy of even our own salvation, and you save us, and you give us work to do, and you add permanence to that work, an eternal benefit to it. We thank you that the one who is faithful in sowing seed, you say, shall doubtlessly return with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him. And that sorrow is turned to joy. In the Lord Jesus' name, amen.